So the question that I started to ask myself in my research was, how can a technology address these problems? Is technology making us smarter about who we trust? Or is it encouraging us to place our trust in the wrong people and the wrong places?
Welcome to Cambridge Forum, live in Harvard Square, and thank you for joining us for what promises to be a timely and somewhat edgy discussion about trust. A small word, but one with huge ramifications in today's complex technological world. Who can you trust? It's the subject of tonight's forum, and also the title of Rachel Botsman's latest book on the subject. I'm Mary Stack, the director of Cambridge Forum, and we're pleased to have Rachel as our guest speaker tonight. It is a time when confidence in institutions and governments is at an all-time low, but when there has been a huge surge in the growth of shared economy companies like Airbnb, Tinder, and Uber. Statistics show that we are shifting our trust away from institutions toward individuals, or some would say strangers, in areas as diverse as dating, banking, to sharing rides, or even hiring nannies. Botsman has been investigating these trends to try and understand how technology is transforming trust and exploring what the implications are for our decision-making in life, work, and business. Botsman completed her postgraduate studies at Harvard and lectures at Oxford. We welcome Rachel Botsman.
Thank you. I thought that I would start with a personal story. It's a very important story to me because when you become obsessed with a topic enough that you dedicate your life to researching it and you want to write a book, there's a point where you start to ask yourself where this fascination has come from. And I realized that my fascination in how we trust people, how we place our faith often in strangers, had started at this very, very young age. So what happened was, around the age of 5, my mum decided she was going to go back to work. And like many women, she needed some help, so she was going to hire a nanny. Now, for some reason, she placed an advert in this posh British magazine called The Lady. So if any of you are Downton Abbey fans, you'll know that The Lady is where people hire their gardeners and their butlers and their nannies. So anyway, this woman who answered was called Doris. And I remember the day Doris walked into our house because she had this really big curly hair, she had these steel-rimmed glasses, and a very, very thick Scottish accent. So every time she said my name, she would roll her R's. And the thing I remember so clearly was she was wearing a Salvation Army uniform, complete with the navy bonnet. Now, these things are very important when they come to trust. They are called trust signals. And trust signals are clues or symbols that we knowingly or unknowingly use to decide whether someone is trustworthy or not. The problem is that some signals are louder than others, and sometimes we get influenced by the wrong things. Now, Doris lived with us for almost 10 months, and for the most part, she was a really good nanny, and there wasn't anything suspicious about her. Until one weekend, she disappeared, and by day 3, my parents are now worried about where Doris is. So they go around to our neighbor's house, and our neighbors are called the Luxembourgs, and my dad says, our nannies were friendly with one another, do you know where Doris is? And he says, that's so funny you've come round, because I've just found out that your nanny and our nanny are running one of the largest drugs rings in North London. It's a complete true story. Now, at this point, my parents are really worried that Doris is going to come home, so they search her room and they find all kinds of things that you really don't want laying around when you have young children. And then what happened was, 3 days later, the police come knocking at the door and they arrest my dad. Because Doris wasn't a member of the Salvation Army going off on a Sunday for charity. She was robbing banks. And she had been involved in an armed bank robbery, and she'd used our Silver Family Volvo estate as a getaway car. Now, I love this story because I like to remind my parents that they left me in the care of a drug-dealing bank robber for almost 10 months, but It is really interesting when you think about it, because my parents say, oh, I believe it or not, they're rational people. They often make good decisions, have good judgment. And so I started to think of how did they make such a bad decision when it came to Doris? Why do we get often place our faith in people who are untrustworthy? And the thing that I realized is that they thought they had enough information to make a decision about her. But in reality, they faced a trust gap. And this, I think, is so profound as to what's happening in society today. And that is that often in our lives, the illusion of information is actually far more dangerous than ignorance. So the question that I started to ask myself in my research was, how can a technology address these problems? Is technology making us smarter about who we trust? Or is it encouraging us to place our trust in the wrong people and the wrong places? So are we, in fact, giving our trust away to the wrong things, and is technology playing a role in that? And this is a really important point, and it's something that I find very hard when I open up the newspapers or I listen to the media, is that the way we're talking about trust is in these very, very general terms. It's actually very dangerous because, you know, we can trust that President Trump will tweet something ridiculous at 3 a.m., but we don't trust him to negotiate with North Korea. We can trust even that Harvey Weinstein could make great movies, but we don't trust his behavior necessarily around women. So this is the first thing that I would like you to think about, is when we're talking about trust, is to keep in mind that in our own lives, but also when we're talking about institutions and leaders and individuals, that trust is highly contextual. You can trust me, hopefully, to write an article or to teach students. Do not get in the car with me because I'm a terrible driver. So. If you look at the surveys, so Reuters, Gallup, Ipsos, Harvard are doing all these kinds of surveys, they're all telling the same sad story. So the narrative is that trust is in a state of crisis. And where this is coming from is that if you look at the surveys, trust in all major institutions, so not just government, but charities, religious organizations, big businesses, and the media, is at an all-time historic low. Now, I urge you to look at these surveys and really dig into their methodology, because one of the problems is the way they ask the question. Do you trust the media? Do you mean, you know, Reddit? Or do you mean the New York Times? What are you trusting the media to do? But that said, you can see an historic pattern. And what we have to look at is not the institutions with the lowest level of trust. So government trust has always been low. Is the institutions with the sharpest decline. And the institution actually with the sharpest decline is the media. In the West, it's around an average of 16 points within less than 12 months, which is very significant. And so there's all kinds of reasons as to why this is happening, and I'm going to explain a little bit why. Because a trust, an erosion of trust is basically a lack of faith. It's a lack of faith or confidence in the system. It's a feeling that the system is failing us. And one of the problems is when you look at how institutional trust works, so this idea that we place our faith, often blind faith, in a few elite leaders, and they get to operate behind closed doors and keep things hidden and keep things secret, that wasn't designed for the digital age. I mean, you see this coming out, like the Weinstein scandal and the movement it's created is a symptom of this, that institutions cannot protect people no matter how powerful they are, when they break people's trust. But I don't think this narrative that trust is in crisis is helpful. I don't think it's healthy to society, because what it actually does is it amplifies people's fears. It amplifies people's anger. But the other reason why I don't like this narrative is because I don't think trust is in crisis. I think there's plenty of trust out there. It's just flowing in different directions and different people. And so this trust, the easiest way to think of it is like energy. And you'll know that energy can't be destroyed. Energy is continually changing form. And so what's happening is trust, our trust that used to flow upwards, whether that be to leaders, to CEOs, to regulators, to experts, to academics, is being inverted. And it's now flowing sideways through networks, through systems, through marketplaces, through technologies, sometimes to complete strangers, sometimes to friends on the internet, sometimes to our colleagues, and sometimes to our peers. And so why is this so profound? Well, when you look back historically and you look at the history of trust, and I promise you it's interesting when you actually go back and you look at how trust really is like the social glue of society. Trust is like liquid gold. Without trust, human beings, they can't trade, they can't collaborate, they can't cooperate, they can't be vulnerable with one another. So trust has always existed. But in its first chapter, very long period in history, trust was local. Really easy to understand. This is when we all lived in villages and communities, and trust was largely personal. So I would trust you because I knew you or someone knew you. And if you did something wrong, you would get a bad reputation. And that would impact your ability to transact or have relationships in the future. Now, what happened is when we went through mass migration, when we wanted to trade internationally, this type of trust didn't work. So as a society, we invented institutional trust. We invented things like corporate brands, brands that would tell us what products and services that we should buy. We invented risk mechanisms like insurance. We invented lots of intermediaries, whether it was real estate brokers or lawyers. And so trust stopped flowing directly between people and started to flow through institutions. Now, I'm not saying these two forms of trust don't exist and shouldn't exist in society, but what's happening is there is a third form of trust rising up and challenging, particularly institutional trust. It's what I call distributed trust. And the irony is that this is a trust that flows directly between people again. It just is flowing at a scale that's never been possible before. And sometimes the other person is a real human being, and other times, it's an artificially intelligent bot or an algorithm. So what I thought I'd now explore with you is some of the consequences of this shift, how distributed trust works, and how we see it enabling incredible things, but also how we're seeing it can be precarious. Because too much trust in the wrong people isn't necessarily a good thing. So, first of all, I want to look at our trust in new ideas. And new ideas, they really could be anything. They could be a new technology, but they could be a new political idea. They could be a new philosophy. So how do people build trust in new ideas? All right, so I'm not sure how this is going to work, but we'll try it. Okay, so actually, I think it's going to be difficult, but let's try it. Let's give it a go. So just take out your phone, and I want you to just swap your phone now with the person behind you or the person next to you. Just find someone to swap your phone with. You must make sure it's unlocked, okay? Great. The gentleman at the back, maybe you want to swap with that lady there. Great. Now, what I want you to do is I'm going to give you 20 seconds to, you can do whatever you want with that person's phone. I'm at a pulpit. I can give you these directions, right? Do whatever you want with that person's phone for the next 20 seconds. It's not a long period of time. Go. I see there's some nervous swappers out there, right? You've got 10 seconds. It's very quiet. 5 more seconds. Okay, now you need to give the phones back. You're all so respectful. This doesn't always happen, right? So I respect some people did not want to play this game, so they pretended they didn't have a phone. I really don't believe you. I think you did have a phone, right? That's okay. And then other of you, you swapped, but you didn't really do anything with the phone, right? You just looked at the other person. And then there was one or two of you that you actually went into that phone, and I don't know what you're doing. I'm not looking at you, don't worry. But you were looking at photos and maybe Facebook, or maybe you sent a message or tweeted something, and you had a really different relationship with that phone. But what I was sensing was it was a little bit uncomfortable, right? It was only 20 seconds, and that was your phone. And so this is what makes many of these ideas so remarkable when we're using technology, whether it's to go on a date or share our homes, often with complete strangers, based on a trust leap. And trust leaps are really important for progress. They're really important for innovation, how we advance as a society. Because what they represent is when we take a risk as human beings to do something new or to differently, to do it differently from the way that we've always done it. So when human beings went from bartering to using money, that was a trust leap. The first time people got in an elevator, that was a trust leap. The first time you use eBay, the first time you put your credit card details into a website, the first time we all get into self-driving cars and let the car take over the wheel, that will be a trust leap. And what technology is doing is it is accelerating the pace at which we're leaping. So it's asking us to leap higher and faster than ever before, which is why as human beings we feel so much change, a constant state of change in our lives. Now, how does trust work? How do these trust leaps work? Well, it doesn't matter whether we're talking about self-driving cars or even like placing your faith in someone that you've just met. Trust is a process. It's not a value. It's not something we can communicate. It's not a word. It's a process that happens between people or things or, as we're going to see, bots and algorithms. Now, whenever you're asking someone to trust, they are in this known state. And human beings, they love being in this known state. That's where we gravitate towards. And whenever you're asking someone to trust, there's something unknown, an unknown place, an unknown person, an unknown idea. And the line between these two things is what we call risk. So risk is the management of uncertainty that matters. Not all risks matter. There's some risks that matter. But risk isn't what pulls people. That force is trust. So the easiest way to think about trust is that it's a bridge between the known and the unknown. And that's why I define trust very simply as a confident relationship to the unknown. Now, this unknown piece is really important because sometimes people think, well, I trust this person because I know the outcome. If you know the outcome, if there is no risk, you don't need trust. You only need trust when there's actually uncertainty or a degree of risk. And so this explains how trust is actually this magical alchemy of being very vulnerable. It's one, there's a trust theorist called Morgan Deutsch, and he said it's this weird mixture of our fears and our hopes and our aspirations. All right, let's move on and let's look at trust in technology, trust in technology companies and platforms. And I'm talking about everything here from things like Uber to things like Facebook. Now, what's really interesting, and I know this is topical at the moment, is another really big driver as to why trust is breaking down is, in fact, misinformation. So the World Economic Forum actually said that misinformation, not just fake news, because there's a distinction, but misinformation is one of the top 10 threats to society. Now, why is it such a threat to society? Well, because what happens is we can go online and we can find information that verifies our fears. And when we find information that verifies our fears, it amplifies our anger. And then this cycle of distrust is magnified. Now, why is that so dangerous? Because certain people, like Trump, they know how to manipulate this cycle. So that's why he's always talking about distrusting the media, because what it does is it creates a vacuum. And it creates a vacuum for conspiracy theories. It creates a vacuum for people who are very smart in talking to feelings over facts. And we may not like it, but he actually represents a form of transparency to many people. He is a voice against things that they didn't believe in, a lack of faith in the establishment and the system. So the worrying thing about misinformation and fake news is that it's very hard to detect. And so when two-thirds of Americans are using Facebook as their source of news, they have outsourced their capacity to trust to an algorithm. And what's interesting to me is that we're very quick to blame the platforms. But the platforms are only a mirror of all our behaviors, of what the community does. And what I've seen is when we don't like what we see, we blame the mirror. Now, I'm not saying these tech companies, like, I'm very hard on them. I think they have to be more accountable. And what's really interesting about Facebook is if you look at the volume, it's the scale of the problem that's so huge. So we post more than 4,000 photos every second, 1.3 million posts every single minute. Do you know how many community moderators they have? They have 7,500 moderators. That means there's one moderator per 466,000 users. So I think what's happening with Facebook is a bigger trend. and that we're starting to say these tech companies are the new institutions of the world. And if they're the new institutions of the world, they have to be more accountable. You know, Facebook can't say it's a pathway that just connects users. It is the media company now in the world. And so we need these platforms to take more responsibility for giving us the tools to reduce the risk of bad things happening, but also to take responsibility when things go wrong. But as I said, we also play a role in this. You know, if we want independent journalism, we should go to the newyorktimes.com or washingtonpost.com. We shouldn't get our news from Facebook. And what this requires is actually very simple. Technology is accelerating trust. We're living in this age of trust on speed. So we click and we swipe and we accept and we share without thinking about whether this thing or this piece of content is worthy of our trust. And so one of the things I think we need to be doing as individuals is taking a trust pause, thinking twice before we share that piece of content or place our faith in a complete stranger. So just to wrap up, I don't want to end on a bad note because there's this very dark mood about technology. And I want to go back to the question I asked you at the beginning, which was, can technology make us smarter about who we trust? And I think it can when it's used in the right way. So I started to research babysitting platforms. And these are really incredible when you think about it, because renting out your home sounds risky, but finding a complete stranger to look after your kids, now that is a crazy idea. And so speaking to the founders, I found out something amazing, is that they're using machine learning to basically, when someone says, yes, I have a clean driving record, or yes, I have a childcare diploma, or yes, I have 10 references and I'm great with kids, or I love children, but yet they hate children online, or they're showing inappropriate pictures, 75% of all people who apply to be a caregiver on Urban Sitter are rejected. And so I said to Lynn, the founder, would Doris have made it onto the platform? And she said, no, Doris would never have made the cut because your parents would have known that she didn't belong to Salvation Army, that she did have a criminal record, and that her references were fake. And so this, I think, is the challenge that we face in society, is that we have to find the right balance between technology and humanness. We, the humans, need to stay in control of the technology versus letting it control us. And really, the way that we do that is we make sure the technology amplifies what it means to be human, that it amplifies our emotional intelligence versus taking over that decision-making. So I think, at the end of the day, the decision on who we trust is a human decision. And each and every one of us can play a role in this. We can all slow down and ask ourselves, is this person or this thing or this piece of information, is it worthy of our trust? And every time we engage in that process, even if it feels small to us, we are, in our own way, taking care of what I think is society's most precious and fragile asset, which is trust. Thank you very much.
You are listening to Cambridge Forum in Harvard Square as we continue our discussion of Who Can You Trust? With Rachel Botsman. Would people like to come up and share their question?
I think, Rachel, that everyone in this room will agree with at least 2 points. The first is that you've identified a very significant phenomenon, and you've addressed it beautifully.
Oh, thank you.
Given that accomplishment, second thing I think everyone in this room would like to hear more about from you immediately would be how we apply your research and your findings in the field of politics and the question of how we redefine politics so it is once again a noble profession. Mm. You and I and everyone else in this room doubtless knows enough to go to the New York Times or the Washington Post, as you said, when we want to check a breaking news story. We don't go to InfoWars or Breitbart, but a significant number of Americans do. Mm. How do we change that so that we can therefore change our politics?
I think it's a great question, and I don't think I have a sufficient answer. I really don't. But I do think it starts at a young age. I really do. I think a lot of this is around education and the way not just politics is taught, but Stanford recently did a study where they looked at educated children and their ability to actually discern information. And I, you know, I teach at Oxford, and some of my graduate students, they cite Wikipedia. And so I think information, how you find the truth, how you fact check things, this is really important. And you know, we saw this in Brexit. It's not just happening here, that my dad is an intelligent man, and he voted to leave Brexit because he believed what they were saying, that they were going to save the NHS £375 million a week. And so I don't have an answer, but I think a lot of it actually comes in making sure people have the right information. And then I think what's also happening is people, this is my view, that we feel very disenchanted with political systems because it feels like politics serves the system, not citizens. So how you change that so that we actually start serving people's needs versus the beast of the system, and I think this is particularly acute in the United States, is the problem. That people, it's not that they've lost their faith in politics, they've lost their faith in the political system. How we restore that, I do not know, but I will give it more thought. I am giving it more thought, so.
You mentioned one shift, which is that people are moving from a society in which you trust institutions primarily, and to a society where people trust, can often trust complete strangers. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a second shift. People have more information than they've ever had before in order to gauge trust. I mean, you talked about these companies that do a deep search on the web to come up with any scrap of information that could have happened decades ago about a person. And this is a tough question, but I think everyone's grappling with it, which is, how do you maintain this balance between people being accountable for what they do and the safety of people, and giving people a chance, to reinvent themselves and to, and it's crazy. I remember going to the UK and searching my name on Google, which I do sometimes, just to see, and there was nothing that came up because they have, well, almost nothing, because they have laws where you're allowed to be forgotten. Yeah. How do you feel about that?
No, I mean, it's something I talk extensively about in the book, because you should have the right to be young and foolish, and you should have the right to delete transgressions. I think that's very different from being accountable and being a good citizen. You should have the right to delete. And so I'm encouraged by not just all the ruling that happened around the right to be forgotten, which was about 2-3 years ago now, but you may have been following what's happening with GDPR. Have you seen this? It's the General Data Protection Regulation. And it's coming out of the European Union, and it's going to be huge. I mean, companies are worried because it gives us not complete control, but we have the right to ask companies now what data they have on us. So this one woman wrote to Tinder, and she thought she'd get maybe 5 pages back. She got 800 pages back. Because, and then she realized, like, they weren't just tracking who she was looking at on Tinder, they were tracking all her locations. They knew where she'd been on dates. She knew how long that she spent on that date. So the ability to actually see what data companies have on us, the right to delete that data, and also the right to demand that that data isn't sold on. And so I do think in this instance, I'm not always an advocate of regulation, but we do need stronger regulation that takes control away from the companies and puts it back in the hands of users and consumers and makes it more visible around what these companies are doing. Because that's the thing that frightens me, is it's not apathy, it's ignorance, because it's kept hidden from us. So I 100% agree with you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You have been listening to Who Can You Trust? A Cambridge Forum being recorded live in Harvard Square in November 2017 with author Rachel Botsman. The event is co-sponsored by the Lowell Institute, the Massachusetts Cultural Council, and Friends of the Cambridge Forum. Thank you for joining us, and please listen again.